You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we talk with a reporter behind a massive investigative project at USA Today, looking at how police departments around the country retaliate against whistleblowers. Now, after a year and nine-ish months of pandemic, those who work from home may have gotten a bit more casual when it comes to fashion choices. There's the classic nice shirt plus sweatpants combo, the fuzzy blanket that's become a full outfit, and of course, t-shirts, lots and lots of t-shirts. That got us to thinking about our favorite t-shirts, the ones we've been wearing for years, the ones we wear just because they make us laugh, the ones we got from someone we love. Now we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite t-shirt of all time that you have owned, past or present? Why do you love it? Is it hilarious? Does it have a sentimental attachment for you? And what is the backstory? Let us know now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. It's all started with an idea from Central Time producer Colleen Leahy, who shares this story to help us get started.
I have a lot of favorite t-shirts, but the one that came to mind immediately is this black t-shirt with a skull and crossbones on it. And the skull has the number 13 on it, and there's a snake like winding through its eyes. And over the top of the skull, it says felon. And I love this shirt because it came from a favorite teacher's garage sale, and she was like kind of goth, and I thought she was really cool. And she told me she got the shirt at the little boy section at Target, and it looks like it. It makes me really happy because it's so absurd.
That's Colleen's t-shirt story. What is yours? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have a favorite t-shirt now or in the past, tell us about it, what it means to you, why it's funny. That's 800-642-1234. I'm kind of a practical t-shirt guy myself, but you can surprise me with your shirt at 800-642-1234. We asked around here at Wisconsin Public Media. Ezra Wall, our Southwest Regional Manager, says, I have a faded t-shirt that features three microphones with wrapped cables and quarter-inch plugs that make a peace sign. It's the most comfortable shirt, Ezra says, I've ever owned. After 15 years, I can no longer wear it in public. But it's still a Saturday morning favorite. My 11-year-old niece is dumbfounded when I tell her the shirt used to be black. It is now gray. Sarah Hopeful, on the other side of the glass there, says, my UW-Milwaukee t-shirt with Animal the Muppet playing the drums on it. Its color has faded and it's a bit stained, but my mom gave it to my grandpa when she was younger, and I'm very happy to have it now. My other favorite t-shirt is a ridiculous white shirt with an alien on it smoking a cigarette with, but is it art, written at the bottom. Sarah says, it's so stupid, I love it. How about you? We're taking your calls. If you have a favorite t-shirt, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let us know the story behind that t-shirt. Weird from a caller in Scandia. Mark says he saw a t-shirt in the New Yorker, one of their cartoons, a shirt that said, I wear this shirt, therefore I am. Do you have a zany t-shirt like that? You can also prove me wrong, because I thought, are people really going to call about their favorite t-shirts? And the producers had to persuade me. So you can prove Rob Ferret wrong right now at 800-642-1234 with your t-shirt story. That's 800-642-1234. Hey, people here at WPR have a lot of t-shirt stories. Bill Martins, producer here on Central Time, says his favorite is from an ice cream shop in Door County called Grumpy's. The logo is an angry-looking ice cream cone holding a root beer float and a thing of popcorn. It's kind of funny. People seem to get a kick out of it. I always get comments when I have it on. It's soft. It fits well. And takes me back to Door County. Bill says I get excited whenever I do laundry away because it means I've, or whenever I put laundry away, because it means I've got it ready to wear again. All right, now you're calling. Deb is with us in Cross Plains. Deb, hi.
Hi. Yes, I have a favorite t-shirt. Actually, I have two. The first one was made after my brother passed away. He was known as Hell Bent. And we had a Freebird on it, like Freebird Lynyrd Skynyrd song.
Sure. Freebird, like that.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, you bet. And then the other one we made when my friends and I were later in high school, and we were just kind of the knockoff girls. We weren't popular, but we had a great little group. We're still friends, and we came up with our name of Choice Bunch. So we
Choice
had T-shirts
Bunch.
Made, Choice Bunch, and we proudly wore them when my girlfriend was at Ames, Iowa College.
Okay.
We wore them all over campus. So.
Now, did you only wear them when you get together, or would you wear that separately, too?
We wore them separately, too.
Excellent.
But,
Deb,
yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. We'll go now to Don in La Crosse. Don, hi.
Hi. I had a gray shirt with a mosquito pictured over the most of the shirt with it saying, "It's time to eat, Minnesota."
I love it. So it did. That's the mosquito that ate Minnesota, or one of many, I guess, Don.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you so much for sharing that. I love it. 800-642-1234. Call in with your favorite T-shirt. Jerry is with us next in Glendale. Jerry, hi.
Oh, hi. I've got two favorite T-shirts. The first one is, I call it My Definition of Love. You see two cats, you're looking at them from the back, there's a nice moon overhead, and one cat says to the other, "If I had two dead rats, I'd give you one." And the other T-shirt was given to me at my bachelor party many years ago. It's the Michelangelo creation of Adam, you know, where there are heavenly figures about to touch fingers.
Right,
where
from
God
the Vatican,
is about...
sure.
That's right. And the... wording on this one is, "Pull my finger."
Okay. I was worried a bachelor party wasn't going to be clean, but that's good-natured fun. I love it. Thank you so much for sharing those with us, Jerry. I love it. We are taking your favorite T-shirts, past or present. Mary joins us next in Chippewa Falls. Mary, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What's your T-shirt, Mary?
Okay. So it's a T-shirt that's the College of William and Mary. And I call it my party shirt. And the reason is my husband's name is William and mine is Mary. So that way I will remember who I came with and who I am.
That's so you go to some pretty rough parties there if you're forgetting by the end of the night, Mary.
Oh, my goodness sakes. We had a great time when we were in Virginia Beach. So, yeah. It was a great party.
I love it, Mary. That's a great story. Katie joins us next in Eau Claire. Katie, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your T-shirt, Katie?
My T-shirt is a saying from The Onion. It was passed down from my sister's best friend to my sister and then to me in high school, and it just simply says, "You are dumb." And I have had it for 25-plus years.
Do you still wear it? I mean, this has been a double hand-me-down plus 25 years. Do you still wear it?
I mean, it's not pretty, but yes, it does get used quite often.
I love it. The Onion's original motto. I think they translated it into Latin later. Time for another caller or two. Nancy is with us in Grafton. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. My Wisconsin license plate said 14 kids because we did have 14 children.
Uh-huh.
And so I had a T-shirt that had, like, my license plate on it. And I think that was pretty neat.
That is pretty cool. Did you make that yourself? Or I'm guessing that would be a great gift for a grandma.
No, I had it made by a company here that in town that made those T-shirts. And I had, 14 kids.
Love it, Nancy. I will take one more caller. Tim is with us in Delavan. Tim, hi.
Hi. I got this shirt from my brother. It just says hello on it, and it has two dogs on it. And one is snipping the other's butt.
And that's a hit at parties, I bet.
It's the best T-shirt I have ever found. People just die laughing when they see it.
I love it. Tim, thank you so much. Thanks to everyone who called in. You can keep sharing your T-shirt stories. Email ideas@WPR.org. We could share some more of them in the future. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Live. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the Macy's of the North.
A thrift shop in Wisconsin's Northwoods is a stark contrast to the Black Friday scene. Jane Hampton takes us to the store in Minocqua, where deals on clothing, cabin decor, and all kinds of stuff draw bargain hunters from far and wide.
Minocqua is a tourist town, but the cute little gift stores are blocks away from the St. Matthias Thrift Shop. It's a plain brick rectangle that used to be a public service building. On a drizzly morning, dozens of shoppers are lined up before doors open at 10. Why are you waiting in line in the rain?
Because it's totally worth it.
What's a lucky find?
My best lucky find was a set of dishes. They were like brand new, sold for $100. I got them for $12.
I'm looking for shoes that fit, and socks.
Finally, the store manager, Jan Degner, unlocks the door.
Are you ready?
Yes! Yes.
All right, be nice to each other and have a good time.
Okay.
Degner's a little nervous about this day. It's the big dollar a bag event when shoppers pay a buck for whatever they can jam into a brown paper grocery bag. The shop gets chaotic.
I'm very particular about how it looks out on the floor so that it doesn't look junky, so that things look well-arranged like a regular store. Some people call it the Macy's of the North.
The Macy's of the North definitely has a woodsy vibe. Degner's husband, Gene, runs the furniture side of things.
If it's an upholstered chair and it has animals on it like deer and bear, they love that.
Loons, deer heads. Those and fish mounds are very popular. I think people like to put them up and say they caught them.
Today, though, the hot sellers are dishes, clothing, and toys.
Like, I love to thrift shop. It's thrilling, to be honest.
Winona Careful of Lac de Flambeau has 4 girls under 8, and the St. Matthias Thrift Shop helps with the budget.
My daughters all have birthdays within about a month of each other, too, so it's a tough time of year.
There's nobody in this neck of the woods that should not have boots, not have a coat, not have furniture.
Barbara Dirksen is one of dozens of local volunteers. She and Degner sift through mountains of donations, everything from junk to gems.
One of our volunteers was going through a bunch of socks that came in, opened up one of the socks, and there was a diamond ring in it. You'll find some that have engraving inside, happy anniversary, and those kind of things. Those are sad. There's many a time we've stood out there in the back room and teared up with family members and hugged, and, you know, there's a lot of personal things going on, too.
What happens is when people sell their cottages, they sell it with all the stuff in it because they don't want it. They don't want to take it home to Chicago. They don't want it. And so now new people buy that house. They don't want that stuff, and it used to go in the dump, and it comes here, and it's perfectly good stuff. They just don't want it. It's not their stuff.
It's a cliche. One person's trash is another one's treasure, but it adds up to big bucks at the thrift shop.
Last year, we gave away $470,000.
The shop gives 10% to the church for outreach and 90% to the community. Dozens of local organizations got grants last year, and yes, they totaled nearly $500,000.
I found it was like a glass goose, and it looked pretty cool.
Are there some clothes in that bag for you?
Yes, a lot.
The thrift store is open all winter, along with a special Christmas shop for the holiday season.
Thank you.
Hey, bye-bye, baby.
Bye.
Bye.
See you later.
Jane Hampton teaches journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and brought us that story on the St. Matthias Thrift Shop in Minocqua. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a new report found hundreds of examples over the last 10 years of police departments in multiple states trying to silence, discredit, or punish officers who call out corruption and violence in their departments. We'll hear from a reporter involved with the project. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. In the trial of Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin in spring of this year, some of his fellow officers testified against him. Ultimately, he was convicted of murdering George Floyd. The fact that they didn't stand in support of him runs counter to the notion of a so-called blue wall of silence, that there's an unwritten code that police department colleagues don't turn each other in. But a new project from USA Today suggests that in many departments that wall still exists and that whistleblowers face more consequences than officers who commit crimes or violate policies. Brett Murphy is an investigative reporter for USA Today. He was part of the effort Brett, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks a lot, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Can you give us a sense of the scope of this reporting project looking into police departments and whistleblowers?
Nationwide. So we were looking at departments large and small across the country and in virtually every state. We filed records requests and did some reporting pretty much everywhere. The goal was breadth and depth, and it took us about a year, three reporters on it full time. So quite a devotion of resources. And we actually started looking into it shortly after the Chauvin case. I was glad you mentioned that. Immediately after that incident, the fellow officers there, their statements justified his use of force. It was only after the video came out, the outcry, the protests, and then the ultimate criminal charges that the department, did not stand by him any longer. So we were curious from the beginning, just how common that phenomenon was, what sort of the mechanisms were that departments used. And that's really what got us going was that case there in Minneapolis.
When police officers do reveal wrongdoing from among their fellow officers, what are some of the most common responses they get from colleagues and departments?
Well, from colleagues, we found in our interviews and records, from colleagues, the reaction is swift. Once they find out very often that one of their own had reported against them or testified against them, it's sort of the typical alienation, ostracization type of stuff. Immediately, those whistleblowers can feel kind of the sidelong glances. And sort of the more egregious cases we found, they would get the dead locker or the dead rats in the lockers, the death threats, that sort of stuff. And they would start to fear for their own safety quite a bit. Those were the extreme cases. The departments themselves, it was a little more formal kind of mechanisms used. Most often we found it was internal affairs would get turned against those officers. They would open up investigations into them for smaller trivial infractions, sometimes going deep into that officer's history to kind of build a case against them. The officers we talked to said that this was, sort of a concerted effort to discredit them and discredit the misconduct that they brought forward, discredit them as witnesses. So that was a pretty common tactic we saw.
Can you talk about one of the stories? You, I believe, reported on one of them in Los Angeles, an officer reporting what appeared to be egregious, basically a gang internal to the police department. Can you share a little bit about that story for us?
Yeah, that's one of the larger scandals that we included in this story. Others have reported on it as well. That's the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. There was an officer there, or a deputy there rather, Art Gonzalez, who exposed a gang of deputies who called themselves the Executioners. It's roiled into a pretty large scandal now. But he, kind of like what I was saying earlier, shortly after Gonzalez came forward, there was pictures of graffiti. Art is a rat on it. There's a dead rat. All that sort of stuff. Then shortly after, he said the supervisors forced him to resign from his position as a training officer. He got his pay cut. So that's sort of the stuff we find pretty often is that, the system comes down on them. And if there's a union, like in the case of Gonzalez, they might abandon the guy or discourage him from moving forward with his complaint. That was part of what we found in Gonzalez's case as well. So that one was, it was a good example of what we found in a lot of places where in any sort of systemic or widespread misconduct was being exposed.
You and your colleagues talked to some experts about possible solutions to make it to increase accountability and to protect whistleblowers. What were some of the suggestions you heard?
We're going to get into this a little more in a story we have coming in the series, but what we found kind of time and again that, there weren't a lot of protections for police whistleblowers. there's very specific and prescriptive reporting avenues that they have. And a lot of those are internal. You know, you have to go up the chain of command. If you go outside of the chain of command, a lot of those complaints or grievances get funneled right back. So a lot of the experts we talked to suggested, you know, kind of devoted reporting avenues, you know, whistleblower hotlines for these people, that they were guaranteed safety if they were to use. Likewise, you know, the legal protections we found in several states are pretty weak, or in some cases non-existent. And if you are an officer looking for, you know, legal protection, the bar is very high. They don't have the same federal First Amendment protections that a lot of others do. So a lot of the experts we talked to discussed, you know, possible legal frameworks that would protect these guys as well. So there were some options out there, you know, we found that could help sort of make it easier for someone looking to report misconduct in their department.
And just our last minute, are there departments around the country that have done better on this?
Yeah, for sure. The cases we found were not in literally every department. There were some that, you know, they received the whistleblower's complaint and then they took action against an officer who was accused of the misconduct. They congratulated or promoted the whistleblower who came forward. So we did find a couple examples of that. At Dell City, Oklahoma, there was a department in New Jersey as well. So, you know, while it was widespread, our reporting did not suggest that it was entirely ubiquitous. However, on the same, you know, same token, we found hundreds of cases of retaliation, but there's likely a lot more out there. The system we found and the officers we talked to said it all has a chilling effect. You know, it works. If there's someone who's made an example of inside of a department, that can discourage others from coming forward.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Brett Murphy, investigative reporter for USA Today, about a series on police whistleblowers and retaliation against them. Tomorrow on Central Time, we'll get advice on making the best use of our time and time blocking. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then pets have become a much bigger deal in the U.S. over the last few decades, and society hasn't always kept up. The author of the new book, Pet Nation, tells us about the reign of cats and dogs. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. In just a few decades, pets took over our hearts and also our economy. In 1998, American pet owners spent $23 billion on their pets. Sounds like a lot until you consider that just two decades later, in 2019, Americans spent over $95 billion on pets. In a new book, our next guest tells us how animals went from being outdoor-only farmhands to the monarchs of many American households. We're listening back to that conversation now, and you can let us know how your pet has changed your life. Pets have become increasingly woven into Americans' daily lives and routines. Did you have family pets growing up? Did they get different treatment than the pets you have today? Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Mark Cushing is founder and CEO of the Animal Policy Group and author of Pet Nation, the inside story of how companion animals are transforming our homes, culture, and economy. We talked with him earlier this fall. Here's a listen to that conversation. Mark, I gave one statistic there, but can you give us a sense of the scope of this rise just in the sheer number of pets we have and money we spend on them? It kind of snuck up on me. How big is this?
Well, we basically doubled the pet population since 1998. We're now close to 200 million pet cats and dogs in the country. That number vastly outstrips the growth of the human population. We're at $110 billion a year in people spending in America on pets. That number is projected by Morgan Stanley, a Wall Street bank, to get to $300 billion or just short of that in only 8 years from now. So it's just getting started. If people wonder if we can't go any further with pets, no, put your seatbelts on. There's a long more way to go.
Your book is not just a story about quantity, though. It's about the quality of our relationships with pets. And you see a big change there. And really just a couple generations. What's the story?
Well, it really began in the childhood of baby boomers, and the pets began, the cats and dogs, to come inside for different reasons. And that time inside that pet owners and families had with pets, they discovered something, which is the medical fact. It's not just a good feeling because your dog or cat's cute, but your oxytocin level in your brain goes up, which is a source of relaxation and happiness and calm. And your cortisol level goes down, which is a source of stress and anxiety. So there's a chemical thing that occurs, and it kind of lit the country on fire, and it was fueled in part by the media, not so much radio. Don't get mad at me, WPR, but it was, you know, Americans spent Sunday night, I think it was 7:30, on their couch watching Lassie. And I say Lassie because it's probably the greatest dog ever, and it did everything right. It was heroic, it was friendly, it was a comfort, it was a pal. It liked to play with you and do everything you wanted. It turns out that dog was created by an author that was a friend of Charles Dickens. So it wasn't exactly a modern writer that created Lassie, but it was a great story, and it fueled a surge at the time, about 30 plus, a little bit more years ago, in media, just presenting pets, dogs and cats in particular, in this different light. And you saw them everywhere, and they were having fun, and it was kind of contagious, and people wanted more pets. It was, in many ways, the signature was the Subaru and Nissan ads, car manufacturers, of course, that showed cars on the California coastal highway. They didn't even tell you a word about the car, its performance features, nothing. They just showed a golden retriever in the passenger seat with its hair flowing in the wind and smiling. And they realized that all you need to do was connect that brand with a dog, a happy dog, and you could sell cars. And the point is, we were surrounded by pets doing other things. And it led to the remarkable fact now, 75% of America's pets sleep on top of the bed of their pet parents or pet owners. So from out of the doghouse, which is a term you don't hear anymore, to, as you, I liked your intro, the monarchs of our homes, and that's very much the case.
We've talked on this show over the years about loneliness in the United States, lack of social connection in some cases. You see the pets not just as like we're going to the pets for the companionship we're not getting from humans. Sometimes those pets lead to the connection with other humans. Connect the dots for us, please, between our social isolation and our pets.
Well, it's interesting. There's a couple of key facts there, and it's a good story. Once commercial media had done its job, social media became a tool, as we all know, with smartphones in the hands of every American. And people became, in effect, their own movie producers and directors, right? And at first, I remember, you saw babies. It seems like social media, Facebook, Instagram, and so forth, babies were the currency, but not anymore. I have five kids. You'd think I'd complain about that, but what was replaced were pets, dogs and cats doing things, little short videos daily. And it allowed people, if you lived in San Diego and you had the same breed as somebody in Portland, Maine, you could become friends. You became part of a group, and you couldn't wait to see the species, you know, the Shih Tzu in Portland, Maine, turn in circles, and then your pet would do it the next day. And it created this culture of connection through social media, and it continues every day today. At the same time, there were studies done in four cities, Perth in Western Australia on the Indian Ocean, which is looks a lot like San Diego, and then Portland, Oregon, Nashville, and San Diego, California, and they studied what it was that makes communities feel safe, more connected, less isolated, basically function better. And they studied neighborhoods in particular. And they went in blind. They weren't trying to prove a point about pets. But it wasn't churches, it wasn't schools, it wasn't sports, it wasn't music, it certainly wasn't politics. It was pets. The strongest factor in building a community culture and a sense of what you call social capital in a community were pets, and that was confirmed in all four cities. And so we discovered that pets not only made you individually feel better, you know, I talked about that a minute ago, but it actually made communities work better. And that was part of the thinking, or if the motivation, if you will, about dogs moving out into every corner of America. And I know in Wisconsin, it's no different than Arizona, where I live, or Manhattan in New York. You can't go anywhere and not see a dog. A store, inside or outside of a restaurant, hotels, hospitals. I mean, think about that. 30 years ago, if you saw a dog in a hospital, it'd be chased outside instantly. You can't find a hospital probably in Wisconsin that doesn't have animal-assisted therapy dogs, who are now part of the treatment plan to take care of patients. Hotels that would have kicked a dog out again, you know, before they got in the lobby, now some have floors reserved for non-pet owners, just to let them know you can come here. But rest assured, the rest of this hotel is full of pets. So it's been a complete transformation, any way you look at it.
We're talking to Mark Cushing about his new book, Pet Nation, the inside story of how companion animals are transforming our homes, culture, and economy. He writes that we have a lot more pets. We treat them differently than we used to. Spend a lot of money on them, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What role does your pet have in your family, in your household? Do you meet people via pets? Maybe you're out walking the dog and talk to other dog walkers out there. Are you glad that businesses accommodate you when you have pets? If you're not a pet owner, do you feel like pets' turf is encroaching on you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you and your pet, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with Mark Cushing about his new book, Pet Nation, the inside story of how companion animals are transforming our homes, culture, and economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your pet or pets, what they mean to you, to your household, to your family, to your social life. Is your pet your best friend, as many Americans say their pets are? Do you have problems in your life with accommodations when you want to, say, travel or go about your daily business? Do you worry that pets are getting a little too much attention and spending in our economy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts, your experiences, and your props to your pet. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Mark, you also look at some of the legal frontiers. We have a lot more pets out there. A lot of people want to go more places with them. Our standards, our laws, and things like that don't always keep up. Where do you see some of the main points of attention, contention right now?
Well, one point that may be the ground zero for issues right now is the workplace. Studies have been done. PhD researcher Carrie O'Hara from UCLA, working for Nationwide Pets, had a remarkable study that showed that employees, including employees that don't own pets, like their company considerably more, and they like their boss considerably more, and will stay longer at their company if it's pet friendly. But there are plenty of people at work that aren't sure about that. Mm-hmm. And so now that people are returning to work or being asked to, as COVID hopefully recedes from the front line, there's a great deal of tension around people's unwillingness, since roughly 20 to 23 million households added or got a first-time pet during COVID. They're not sure they want to go back. They got used to being with their dog or cat during the day. That's a tension point. It's not a legal issue because a company has a right to say you can't, you know, bring a dog into our office. But it's certainly an employee relations issue at a time when the entire country is experiencing a shortage of employees. I mean, businesses, small businesses in particular, cannot find workers. So that's an issue, number one. Another one is housing. Millennials and Gen Zs, right now own 60% of the pets in America. They have sent a signal to apartment developers in Milwaukee and Madison and Chicago and LA and New York. It doesn't matter where. If you want us to be your apartment building, it's going to be pet friendly. That's been a 5-year only transformation. My team did a study in 2015 and ranked the cities according to being pet friendly in housing. And there were laggards that might surprise you, but since that time, there's been a great deal of housing for millennials, particularly in the urban core, you know, inside Milwaukee, I'm sure, inside the core of Madison and Wisconsin, and certainly Chicago. And guess what? Find one that's not pet friendly. I'll be surprised. But public housing is supposed to be pet friendly by federal law, particularly if it's financed by the federal government. And that's a very serious disappointment. People that need public housing aren't staffed by lawyers. They don't walk in with a lawyer on their left or right side saying, give me all the rights I have in this apartment. One of those rights is to have a pet. And we did a study and found out surprisingly few honor that requirement. And it's a part of the population that may need the companionship of pets more than anything. And that's a great disappointment. That's a challenge, obviously. Airlines have become a new battleground because surprisingly during COVID, when air travel was tapering off and airlines were struggling and still are struggling, the TSA and airlines got tougher on pets. And I can't yet figure out why they thought that was necessary, but perhaps the people that didn't like pets or had allergies sometimes complain more vigorously. That's been a battleground. There's also issues surrounding animal abuse. Now, what's that have to do with it? Well, a great number of peer-reviewed academic studies have shown, sadly, but maybe not surprisingly, domestic adult felons, men that commit violence against women as adults, got their start abusing animals. It's almost like it was spring training or a training ground. I don't like to say that casually, but that was very disturbing. So you have the good side of animals, and of course, animals had nothing to do with being victims, serving as a source of pleasure for people that end up, you know, harming, you know, and in some cases killing women as adults. And the states haven't, frankly, increased the severity of animal abuse laws, sanctions, penalties, or even the duties of veterinarians to report animal abuse, as other countries have done. And I think that's an area the United States needs to catch up. I'll stop there, but that's a good start.
Talking to Mark Cushing about his new book, Pet Nation, the inside story of how companion animals are transforming our homes, culture, and economy. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Invited you to tell us about your pets. Mary is with us now in Fond du Lac. Mary, hi.
Oh, hello. This man that you have on is just wonderfully informative. We have two dogs and one cat. We had to get rid of one cat, but we have the other one. They are just so important to us. All our kids left, and we didn't have any pets in the house. And then my daughter got a puppy. He was with us all winter, and he brought such joy just to watch him and play with him. And he's such a happy dog. It's just amazing. Now we have a lab puppy who's about 2 months old and just a hell of a lot of work, but boy, she's pretty fun to watch too. And then we have an adult cat, and I just love watching her. She's my girl. She's pretty old, so.
Mary, thank you so much for sharing your team with us there. I appreciate it. Mark, I'm guessing, so Mary had an empty nest there and filled it up with some pets and is pretty happy about it. I'm guessing she's not alone.
No, it's common. Of course, it happens on the other end. You see millennials mm-hmm. who have pets before they have children. I don't think they're making a choice any more than she made a choice. You know, life happened the way it happened or unfolded in the manner it did. I don't think millennials are saying, do I get a cat or do I get a kid? But they grew up in families with pets and they're going to have pets. And they do, as I mentioned earlier. And it's interesting. You often hear people refer to pets as the new children. I think that's an insult to pets. I think pets have a much better deal than a lot of kids have, and they don't have a teenage phase. So as a parent of five, that has its advantages, but it's been interesting to see the extent to which people's activities, particularly just on a weekend, hanging out with their pet wherever they go. I mean, that strikes some people still as odd. A fellow the other day said to me, you know, I went into Home Depot and I must have counted 10 dogs there, and it seemed really strange. And I said, what was strange about it? Did they bother you or bark or bite? He said, no, it just seemed weird. I said, well, do you think they were there because the dog wanted to go, or do you think the person did? They said, well, I guess it was the person. I said, yeah, people like to spend time with their dogs, in particular outside the house, and you know, get used to it. And I think what the next frontier is going to be is America becomes more like Paris, France, where it is not uncommon to see dogs inside restaurants. And I think I'm going to guess in Milwaukee, particularly with the cold winters, that it's not the norm for restaurants. In some cases, public health codes do not allow dogs inside the restaurant. In France, they do. And I suspect in 5-10 years, we'll see that barrier removed. I bet it becomes common in America to see a dog inside of a restaurant.
Thanks a lot for that call. Go to Deanna now in Milwaukee. Deanna, hi.
Hi. So I have a roommate, and she grew up and she never had pets in her house. And I've grown up and I've always had something, a dog, a cat. I have pet rats, actually. And about a month or so ago, our upstairs neighbor passed away suddenly. And the family asked us if we would take in the cat. And the cat, her name is Arcee. She was very apprehensive about moving into a new apartment. And my roommate Melody was kind of apprehensive about having an animal. And just seeing this transformation in my friend going from apprehension of what is this going to be like, I have to share my home with this animal, to just now they're inseparable. And Melody is just in love with this cat, and the cat is in love with her. And the Melody had surgery, and Arcee, the cat, kind of sat on the couch and was watching over her. And she mentions to me all the time, Melody, that, you know, I don't know why I like this cat so much. I come home and I see her, and there's so much joy in her being there. And I love having her around. And it's something that's hard to describe, but just something that's always been in my life that is difficult to explain. But I'm so excited that she gets to experience that now, and that the cat came into our life.
Deanna, thanks so much. We just have a half a minute left, Mark. A lot of people, it sounds like, are making that exact discovery.
Yeah, no question. And I'll end. There are a lot of Catholics in Wisconsin. I just know that from prior studies. And my mom is a dear Irish Catholic who's passed away, and she's never forgiven me, because in my book, and I did a blog about this, which she read before she passed away, hopefully not the cause of her passing away at 94. I take on the Pope, Pope Francis I, who picked the name Francis from Francis of Assisi, who's the patron saint of animals, right? But he gave a sermon, and then a series of sermons, and then a long interview with an Argentinian newspaper criticizing people's devotion and enjoyment of pets. And he had this weird... And it's just wrong. Sorry about that, Francis, but you were just wrong on this. His theory is the zero-sum idea, that if you love your pet, you can love your pet too much, and you have no love and caring and empathy left for people. And it's just the opposite. That caller's example was a good case of it. You have pets bring the best out in people. You have people that were sort of grumpy and isolated that suddenly are engaged with the world.
And that's where we'll leave it. That's Mark Cushing, author of the new book, Pet Nation, the inside story of how companion animals are transforming our homes, culture, and economy. Coming up after the news, we'll get advice on having productive conversations about race and racism. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.